InfoTrack, the weekly show with information you should know. Here's your host, Chris Whitting.
America's struggle with drug addiction continues. But is the addiction treatment system helping? Here with the story, InfoTrack reporter Roy Mackey. Roy?
Thank you, Chris. Shoshana Walter is a reporter with the Marshall Project and now the author of Rehab, an American Scandal, a book that takes a hard look at the current state of the nation's addiction treatment industry. Shoshana, your book begins with a striking paradox. Treatment access has expanded enormously since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, yet overdose deaths keep climbing. Why hasn't broader access translated into better outcomes?
Well, the system that we have, unfortunately, is just not operating like the solution that lawmakers had once hoped. You know, the Affordable Care Act expanded addiction treatment to millions of Americans, but insurance companies are often paying for very short bursts of treatment, 30 days, 60 days, that unfortunately actually fuel relapse rates. You know, we now know that someone who completes a 30-day treatment program is much more likely to overdose and die in the year following treatment than someone who failed to complete the program altogether.
Your book also exposes practices that you believe exploit vulnerable patients. What forms of abuse are most widespread today, and what needs to happen from a regulatory standpoint to fix that?
One of the treatment models that I write about is typically an unlicensed program that requires unpaid work. So there's actually someone in my book named Chris Kuhn. He's a young middle-class white guy from Louisiana. When he was struggling with his addiction, he was arrested and court-ordered to a program called the Senecor Foundation, where he was told he would receive 2 years of treatment, counseling, medical care. He'd be able to work and live there and save up money for after he left. But when he arrived, he realized that most of his time would be spent working up to 80 hours per week in really tough manual labor jobs. I mean, at the time Chris was there, this program was sending people to work at Exxon and Shell oil refineries. Chris himself laid asphalt in broiling Louisiana heat. He cleaned up after LSU football games and built scaffolds at chemical plants. So these are really, really tough jobs at for-profit companies for which he was only paid a single pack of cigarettes per week and rarely had time for counseling or any medical care. And this experience that Chris had is far from unusual. There are thousands of people across the United States who have been court-ordered or entered a program that required unpaid labor. And what I learned in my book is that that model of treatment, if you could call it treatment, is incredibly exploitive and really causes a great deal of harm.
So these organizations are actually earning money from the patients working?
Exactly. It's almost operating like a temp staffing agency, except the people who are doing the labor aren't actually paid anything at all.
Your book, Rehab, contrasts the experiences of Black and white Americans within the treatment system. How do racism, poverty, and privilege still determine who gets genuine help and who is punished or abandoned?
There are humongous racial disparities in who has access to treatment, who is even able to complete treatment, and then what happens once someone leaves treatment. I spoke with researchers across the country who told me about this concept called recovery capital. That is the mixture of internal and external resources that people really need in order to enter and sustain recovery. And that includes community and social support. It includes housing, financial stability, jobs, food, transportation, basically all of the necessities that anyone, you or I, really need in order to live a productive life. These same elements are essential parts of the recovery process. And too often in our treatment system, those elements are not being addressed. People need access to recovery capital in order to actually enter and remain in recovery. And unfortunately, in the United States, because of our drug laws, addiction often comes with tremendous consequences. And when treatment facilities don't help people overcome those consequences, it can be almost as much of an obstacle to recovery as the addiction itself.
You also mentioned that women, especially mothers and pregnant women, are often denied treatment, leading to higher overdose deaths and more children entering foster care. What needs to change to make rehab more accessible to women?
That's a great question. About 70% of women struggling with addiction have children. It's one of the key reasons that women often cite for not entering treatment. And we've known for decades that treatment programs that allow women to bring their children or that provide childcare have better outcomes for the entire family. But since the opioid epidemic began, the number of such programs throughout the country have actually declined drastically. So today, a woman in need of treatment who has children is only able to find treatment facilities that allow her to bring her children less than 3% of the time. And only about 5% of facilities nationwide provide childcare. So when women are not able to take into account their children in their search for addiction treatment, that often leads to overdose, deadly overdose. We're in a maternal overdose death crisis, or it leads to the separation of families. And that's what we're seeing still to this day across the country.
There's a medication treatment called Suboxone. Tell us what that is and why you have concerns about that.
Suboxone is one of the addiction treatment medications that is considered the gold standard of addiction treatment in the United States for opioid use disorder. And it's essentially a substitute for illicit opioids. It operates by stimulating the same receptors in the brain that are stimulated by illicit opioids. And similarly, you know, we've known for decades that medications like Suboxone are incredibly important. Suboxone, buprenorphine, methadone, they reduce overdose deaths by more than 50%. But since the United States first made Suboxone available to patients across the country, we've also limited its availability by enforcing restrictions on its availability, by passing patient limits, by requiring doctors to undergo the oversight of the Drug Enforcement Administration. And so access to this medication has always been limited. And although the White House lifted some of those restrictions several years ago, we still see doctors who are afraid to prescribe Suboxone. And then on the other hand, you also see treatment programs in California in particular that overprescribe it. You know, one of the programs that I wrote about in my book actually was prescribing Suboxone to people who didn't even have a history of opioid addiction. And the problem with Suboxone is that in combination with other medications, it also can come with an overdose death risk. And so people in this program were being given medications that were not appropriate for them. And in several cases, that led in part to their deaths. And what we see across the country is regulators failing to take action, failing to reel in really dangerous, unethical practices at treatment programs. And so there is this situation we have in the United States where regulators are offering very poor oversight over the treatment industry. And at the same time, we're putting way too many restrictions on medications that are proven to help people recover from addiction. So it's a real issue in terms of people being able to access an evidence-based treatment and access quality addiction treatment around the country.
Can you broaden that out a little bit in terms of what treatments do you think should be happening now that are difficult to access and maybe some of that are a waste as well?
I think people still have enormous difficulty accessing addiction treatment medications. People are entering treatment programs that are really just short bursts of treatment that do not provide them with what they need for when they leave the program. So I spoke with treatment facility owners across the country who are actually really frustrated by the limitations that are often imposed by insurance companies on length of treatment, on access to treatment. And even these treatment facility owners refer to it as a cycler. You know, people go into a treatment facility, they complete it, they leave, then they relapse, and they just come back in again. And unfortunately, there are a lot of predatory, very profit-oriented treatment programs around the country that now view that relapse as part of their business model of treatment. It's a guaranteed customer base. And instead of providing ongoing support and care following a residential treatment program, Many programs simply hire staff who call up former participants, find out if they relapsed. And if they did, especially if they had high-paying insurance, they would be re-enrolled again. And that's just kind of become the standard practice across the treatment industry. And it's very expensive, and it's just really not working the way it should.
How do you see the effect of cultural attitudes towards treatment recovery? People who believe that addiction is a personal failure, for example.
Well, I think that personal responsibility is an important part of the recovery process. You know, I spoke with hundreds of people who've struggled with addiction, who are in recovery, out of recovery. And I also spoke with dozens of researchers across the United States. And I think everyone would agree that in order for someone to actually recover, they have to have a sense of confidence and a sense of control over their lives. It's often called self-efficacy, this feeling that someone has that they can make decisions in their own lives, they feel good about those decisions and can confidently execute them. That's an important part of the recovery process. I think the problem is that when it comes to addiction treatment, too often people are told that they need to hit the rock bottom, that they're at their lowest point in their lives before they can change. And the problem with that is that it can strip people of their confidence. It can make people feel hopeless. And when someone is at the rock bottom, it's incredibly easy for that person to be exploited for profit, for unpaid labor, for billable services via their insurance programs. And so the situation that people often find themselves in is very ripe for exploitation.
If you could change one structural element of the addiction treatment industry, what would you change?
I know from speaking with researchers across the country that people really need longer-term support in order to sustain long-term recovery. And that can include the use of addiction treatment medications, therapy, but it also includes all these elements we were talking about earlier, these elements of recovery capital, these basic necessities that people need in their daily lives in order to actually remain sober and in recovery. I think that the treatment industry would see a lot more success if they focused on these long-term needs of people who are leaving rehab instead of this cycle of rehab that often fuels relapse. And unfortunately, in the age of fentanyl and other illicit drugs now coursing through our system, can often be deadly.
Finally, there are no doubt many people listening to this right now who are struggling with addiction or perhaps have a family member who is. What advice would you give them?
I think the first thing I would say to them is that I feel an enormous amount of sympathy for anyone who's going through this experience right now. For those families who are looking for treatment programs for a loved one who is struggling with addiction, it can feel absolutely frustrating, terrifying, and horrifying. And it can be really difficult to figure out, you know, where to turn. The U.S. government still has a website that people can access called treatmentfinder.gov. And I think that would be the first place I would start to see what treatment programs are available near your community, near that person's source of support. I don't think it's a necessity for a lot of people to travel across the country to go to a residential rehab program. Sometimes what's going to be most beneficial is remaining in the place where you have people who love you and support you and beginning the long-term process of change there. I would look up local programs. I would make sure that the program you're considering going to is licensed. I would call up the program, find out what happens on a day-to-day basis at that program, what kind of clinicians are available to help you with mental health diagnoses, as well as an addiction diagnosis. And I would look for certain red flags. If the program is much more focused on the amenities than on the treatment services, I think that's a red flag. If a program is drug testing rehab patients on a daily or almost daily basis, that's also a red flag. It may be a sign that that program is overbilling insurance companies for services that are not necessary. There are lots of great resources out there online for people who are looking to identify a good treatment program, and don't rush into a program just because you need it. I would rely on people that you know to help you find a program that's going to meet your needs.
Shoshana Walter, the author of Rehab and American Scandal. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Roy.
And for InfoTrack, I'm Roy Mackey.
Next, giving to others will make your life better. As InfoTrack continues,
you're listening to InfoTrack. More after this.